It is entirely possible, you know, that the virus actually is not in charge of this economy anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 17th of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. If you were to ignore for just the briefest of moments the prospect of a land war in Europe, which, yes, I know. But anyway, you set that aside, and this has not been the worst of weeks for the American economy. We got the latest numbers on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning. A proxy for layoffs, right, is a good way to think about that. And yes, they were up a bit last week, but the four-week moving average fell back down toward December's pre-Omicron levels. Retail sales, we got yesterday, told you about that, way up despite Omicron. Industrial production, that's up too, almost 1.5%. So again, is it possible this virus is not in charge of this economy anymore? Fingers crossed, right? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Make no mistake, the Omicron wave has been severe, says Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics.
In terms of huge numbers getting infected with the virus, many people sadly dying as well, but purely in terms of the economic impact, I mean, the impact there has actually been remarkably limited.
That's despite a record 3 million workers out sick at the peak of Omicron last month.
The economy is sort of learning to live with the virus. Businesses have adapted to cope with having more flexibility and being able to deal with these temporary staff absences that are a sort of ongoing feature of the pandemic.
Similar story with consumers. Kayla Brune at Morning Consult has been tracking how willing we are to return to activities we used to do.
With dining and with travel, other categories that tend to be affected by increased perceived health risks associated with the pandemic. There was a little dip for all of them, but for the most part, it's already come back to where it was.
So what about workers? A new report from the Pew Research Center finds that most people who are still working from home are doing so by choice, says researcher Juliana Horowitz.
And the shares who say concerns about being exposed to COVID have dropped.
Except that's not true for people who can't work from home and have face-to-face contact with the public.
Those with lower incomes, and we also see some racial differences with Black workers being particularly likely to say they're very concerned about being exposed to COVID at work.
And finally, in some ways, we seem to be shrugging off the pandemic altogether, says Ted Rossman at Bankrate.
Which is maybe not so much of a good thing. Like credit card balances are rapidly going right back to where they were. The personal saving rate has returned to normal, well down from its pandemic highs.
Maybe our consumer mantra is reverting to norm. Delta, Omicron, another variant yet to be named. What, me, worry? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Oh, Mitchell. On Wall Street today. Well, look, before I tell you that, let me tell you this. In the minutes of the Fed's January meeting that I told you about yesterday, the word inflation came up 73 times. Makes sense, right? Inflation is their job. The word geopolitical, which you can read as Russia, 4 times, which is a lot for a central bank. And thus, Wall Street today went from not good all the way to bad at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on who you ask, the United States has a shortage of somewhere between 1 million and more than 5 million homes. So the news this morning that housing starts, which is literally groundbreaking on new homes, the news that it fell last month, well, that's not great. We've told you about all the shortages and delays gumming up the housing works. Land, labor, and materials are the big three. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that ain't all of it.
At first glance, a decline in home building is not a great start to the year, but 1 month does not a trend make. And Rick Palacios Jr. with John Burns Real Estate Consulting says January was kind of a funky month. Not only was it colder and snowier than usual in many parts of the country, but also
upwards of 50% of the construction trades had absenteeism due to COVID Omicron surge.
As that surge continues to wane and the weather warms, he and other analysts expect building to pick up. Odetta Kushi is deputy chief economist at First American, a title insurance company.
Permits, which are a leading indicator of future housing starts, actually increased. So that increase in permits represents the green shoots of some much needed housing supply.
But will it be enough? Probably not. Robert Dietz is chief economist of the National Association of Home Builders. At the group's annual convention in Orlando last week, he briefed members on what he called the crosswinds holding the industry back, including rising mortgage rates, which could slow down sales as homes become less affordable.
The result is that we're looking at about a 1% growth rate for 2022, and then roughly flat over the next 2 years, as higher interest rates produce something like what we saw during the second half of 2018.
That's when 30-year mortgage rates climbed to 5%.
And we had a housing soft patch that followed, 2 to 3 quarters, where a lot of the housing data moved sideways.
Given how much higher home prices are today, Dietz says even 4% could have the same effect. According to Freddie Mac today, the average on a 30-year fixed is up to just over 3.9%. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's a gap in this economy between the economic fortunes of college-educated workers and the nearly two-thirds of Americans without a degree. And that gap has been getting wider for decades now. Part of that is the way the economy has changed from manufacturing to services. But another part of it is something called degree inflation, that an increasing number of well-paying jobs require college degrees, even jobs that didn't used to. And a couple of new studies show just how many workers have been affected by that and what companies are doing about it. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Growing up, Nadira Harris had a clear vision for her future.
I just had this blueprint that I was going to go to school, get a degree, get the job.
She dreamed of becoming a filmmaker and in 2013 began pursuing degrees in film and journalism at Hampton University in Virginia. But a couple years into her studies, financial difficulties forced her to leave the program.
I was crushed. I felt like everything I ever worked for was down the drain because I wasn't able to finish my bachelor's degree program.
That's when she found Year Up, a nonprofit tuition-free job training program that eventually led to an apprenticeship with Accenture, a multinational business services firm.
It was like the doors of heaven just opened. It was like, ta-da!
Harris got on-the-job training, working as a business analyst on a team developing an app. In 2019, she was hired full-time by Accenture and, about a year ago, promoted to senior marketing analyst, a role with an average $84,000 salary, according to Glassdoor.
It just allowed me to get my second chance and show what I'm really made of, you know?
And yet too many people are missing out on these kinds of opportunities, says Papia DeBroy, who leads research at the nonprofit Opportunity at Work.
There are more than 70 million workers in our U.S. labor force today who are skilled through alternative routes.
Stars, as she calls them, have been increasingly excluded from upwardly mobile jobs, roles in computer support, healthcare, sales. They used to be filled by a greater share of workers without college degrees. But over the last 20 years, the numbers have dwindled.
That decline actually translated to stars being displaced from almost 7.5 million jobs.
The biggest shift happened after the Great Recession, when high unemployment, even among college graduates, meant competition for all jobs was fierce. But even as the job market improved, degree requirements often persisted. Joseph Fuller at Harvard Business School says there's one big reason.
The ubiquity of applicant tracking systems, AI to winnow down a big pool of applicants into a smaller pool of candidates.
With the advent of online hiring, companies often get hundreds of applications for each job and usually interview fewer than 10 candidates. So in the name of efficiency, Fuller says, employers use a college degree as a proxy to filter applications for all kinds of technical and social skills.
It's looking at candidates in this binary 1-0 way.
Now, it's a hot job market, so an increasing number of companies are moving away from this binary thinking, like Nadira Harris's employer, Accenture, where nearly half of all jobs don't require a college degree, from cybersecurity analysts to project managers. Accenture North America CEO Jimmy Etheridge says employers need to think differently about how they look for talent. For instance, he says people with a customer service background often have great people skills.
It's easier to teach them the technology, and they already have amazing skills for doing client and customer interaction.
To teach tech skills, Accenture expanded its apprenticeship program from a small corporate responsibility initiative with about 10 participants 5 years ago to a major pipeline of talent with hundreds of graduates. Nadira Harris says she still wants to go back to school and earn that degree someday, but when it makes sense for her.
I think it's always a cutoff. Like, if you don't get the degree, you're never going to be anything in life. And it's just like, no, that's not it.
She has a good job, one that calls on her passion for communication and offers her opportunities for growth. But she didn't have to graduate college to get it. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They're very sharp. They're very heavy looking.
Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today, foreshore. Dow Industrial's down 622, 1.8%, 34,312. The NASDAQ off 407 points. That is 2.9%, 13,716. The S&P 500 dropped 94 points, about 2.2%. 43.80 there. We heard from Amy Scott. The new housing starts down 4% last month. She looked at what it'll take to build enough housing when the industry is still facing all those shortages. So some home building stocks. Pulte Group down 2.7%. Toll Brothers down 3.1%. Megan McCarty-Carino talking about education. So some education stocks. Graham Holdings, which owns Kaplan Test Prep, lost 2.2% today. Chegg Incorporated, that's a textbook rental company. We've had the CEO on the show, actually, I think. Down 3.3%. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note down, interestingly, 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The macroeconomic and environmental acronym of the day today is SAF, Sustainable Aviation Fuel, green gas for commercial airliners. Getting air travel and cargo to carbon neutral has always been a tough nut to crack. Planes have to go really far. They're also really heavy. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, that whole idea is getting some lift.
You remember that part right at the beginning of Back to the Future 2 where Doc opens the lid off of Marty's trash can and starts putting banana peels into the DeLorean's fuel tank?
Wait a minute, what are you doing, Doc?
I need fuel!
Alright, even if you don't, the idea was that in the future, we would use waste to power our vehicles. Joshua Hine at the University of Dayton says we're not really that far off when it comes to sustainable aviation fuels, or SAFs, as folks in the space like to call them.
We're not packing quite the same energy density as Doc would need to fly around in the DeLorean, but waste feedstocks are really the first commercialized SAF feedstock source.
SAFs are what's called a drop-in fuel. Airlines can blend it with jet fuel and put it in a jet without completely redesigning the engine. Kristen Brandt is a research engineer at Washington State University.
That's a really big deal because an airplane lasts 30 or 40 years. So if you're having to change over airplanes for new technology, it's a massive amount of capital.
Shell says it aims to produce around 2 million tons of sustainable aviation fuel a year by 2025. That's 10 times more than it currently does. Dan Rutherford, aviation director at the International Council on Clean Transportation, says multinationals like Shell focusing on sustainable aviation fuels is a good thing, but only one piece of the puzzle. He says more innovation and extensive regulation is needed to encourage a rethinking of the entire airline industry.
I've been watching this space for about 10 years and really haven't seen the needle move. It's because voluntary goals don't work. They don't drive markets.
The Biden administration has set a goal of net zero emissions in aviation by 2050. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Mitchell was talking earlier a little bit about the number of people working or not in this economy. And you know, one of the through lines of this pandemic is that changes to how and where we work are having some perhaps unintended consequences. One of them is the supply and the demand of breast milk. Last month, breast milk banks put out a call for more donors because the current supply is being used up more quickly than expected. So we got Lindsay Groff on the phone. She is the executive director at the Human Milk Banking Association of North America.
What we've seen lately is that, unlike the early days of the pandemic, currently we're seeing less donor turnout. And that could be for a number of factors. The later pandemic days have different stressors than the early days did. And unlike when we were in lockdown, mothers and babies, parents and babies were close together. That often produces a lot of milk. Those things are changing. Supply chain issues and those winter storms have effect on supplies coming into our banks. Hmm. We rely heavily on overnight shipping to ensure that the milk is kept in a frozen state. So there are a number of factors all coming into play, exacerbated by the pandemic, that really has us calling for people to donate now more than ever.
I hadn't even thought about the overnight shipping thing. I mean, of course, right? It's you know, it's a perishable product. Once the moms and their babies get out of the NICU, or I guess the babies, and then their moms go home with them, and mom eventually will go back to work, then that becomes another issue as well, right? Women in the workplace who have to either, if they can't lactate there, if they can't express the milk, they have to provide otherwise for their child.
That's right. So one of those ways is if a mother's own milk doesn't come in right away, say, for instance, she has a medical issue or a baby is born prematurely, donor milk can be used as a bridge so that she eventually, when her milk comes in, she can provide that milk to her own child. Sometimes what happens is what we've seen when the milk does come in, those mothers who were recipients of donor milk, oftentimes if they're pumping, they find themselves in the fortunate position of being able to provide their excess milk and become a donor, which is a really cool full circle moment.
Yeah. I imagine some part of your staff is in the business of forecasting your needs. What are you guessing as, fingers crossed, we come out from under this pandemic and life stabilizes a bit? Do you suppose your demand-supply curve stabilizes a bit?
I sure hope that things stabilize. We have new numbers out. So what we've seen, we distributed collectively 9.2 million ounces of donated breast milk in 2021, which is a significant increase, 22% actually, from 2020. So, you know, we can do the best that we can to predict. But what is constant, just like the blood banks, is there will always be a need for donor milk. I'd like to see people continually stepping up to donate to ensure that this life-saving intervention is available for every infant that needs it.
Hmm. Lindsay Groff is the executive director at the Human Milk Banking Association of North America. Ms. Groff, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right, here's a story where the pandemic giveth and the pandemic also taketh away. Americans bought more than $28 billion worth of toys last year. That is according to NPD Group. It's up 13% from the year before. And you get it, right? As the pandemic dragged on, parents did whatever it took to keep the kids occupied. Here, have a new toy. Turns out one of the hottest areas within toys are building sets, blocks and magnetiles, and yes, Legos, of course, right? But if you were trying to launch a new construction toy, the pandemic has done you absolutely no good. Toy fairs have been canceled, the marketing landscape has changed, and we just haven't been going to actual toy stores much. So what then, Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes wanted to know, is an aspiring toy maker to do?
Most people wouldn't accuse Legos of being too adult, but toy designer Asaf Eshet does.
They're very rigid, they're very sharp, they're very heavy looking. And I was like, kids think differently.
So Eshet created a different building toy called Clixo. The pieces are flat and flexible, made of brightly colored recycled plastic. The core shape looks a bit like a flat fidget spinner with magnets in each of its rounded ends. You can bend and connect the pieces by clicking the magnets together and forming different shapes.
It has the right bounciness and the right feedback when you play with it. You fold, but it doesn't crease and it goes back into shape.
Eshet is at Clixo's only retail store, which is in Brooklyn. Like any self-respecting toy maker, he lives upstairs. He opened the store during the pandemic when the toy launched, because in order for people to buy a new toy, they have to know it exists and try it out. So kids can play with Clixo here and stick their projects to a magnetic wall. Merchandise starts at $17.99 a pack. It's stored in a real yellow Volkswagen Beetle, which greets customers who open its hood.
Hi!
Marketplace enlisted two testers to come to the store. Brothers, who are right in Clixo's target age range. Jagger Clemens is 8 and Thelonious Clemens is 5.
I will roll it up into a ball. I'm going to try and make a suit of armor.
Jagger attaches the Clixo pieces together to make a sleeve for his suit of armor.
Put my arm right there. Oh, wait. Ay, ay, ay.
Clixo is relying on kids to get hooked on the toy, both in the store and in the classroom. The company paid Andy Young, who teaches pre-K at a public school in Flushing, Queens, to create activities using Clixo. Young got into it and started including the toy in his own lessons.
One of the monuments that Flushing is known for is the big Unisphere that you may have seen in the Men in Black movies. So I showed a picture of that, and I asked them to recreate that using Clixo. And there were some wonderful ideas.
Whether this kind of engagement will lead to increased sales isn't clear. Clixo won't give any figures. And a good idea is no guarantee of success.
I see great concepts all the time, and it's not going to go anywhere unless you can break through.
Chris Byrne is an independent toy analyst. He will tell you when it comes to the building toy market, everything comes back to, yeah, Lego.
It's really hard to catch on because when you've got a kid who is a Lego fan, you have to convince them to put down the Lego to pick up something new.
This is why the road to the toy box is littered with tiny Lego pieces that will jab your business plan right in the foot. So as people start to shop in stores again, Byrne says in order for new toys to compete, they need to be in stores, though they might not want to start with the biggest ones.
You know, if you're at Target, you have a window in which to hit a certain level of sales. And if you don't hit that, you're going to be delisted, right? And you're not going to get a second bite at the apple.
Byrne points to building sets that didn't make it big, like Capsella, which included plastic spheres and motors. Here's an old commercial.
You can discover Capsella, the construction set of tomorrow.
Byrne says Capsella appealed more to people who wanted a hobby as opposed to kids who just wanted to play. And for a toy to be really successful, iconic even, it needs to appeal to everyone. So while Clixo's creator may think Legos are too adult, he wants to appeal to that audience too. That's why the next sets will be released in black and a tasteful shade of sand. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw this in the New York Times this morning, and it is not good news if you're in the market for a car, new or otherwise. AutoNation, the biggest auto retailer in the country, says fully half of all the new cars that get to dealers' lots are already sold. Somebody's waiting for them. And if you want something upscale, a luxury brand, almost 3 of 4 of them are gone as soon as they hit the lot, too. The company says it figures the inventory squeeze lasts at least through the first half of the year. Obviously, a tight new car market drives a tight used car market. Lather, rinse, repeat. All right, off we go. But first, your moment of economic context. You know how we tell you every now and then that inflation is a global thing right now? Well, we tell you that because it is. We learned this week inflation over in the UK is up 5.5% from a year ago, the highest it's been over there in 30 years. Their measurement, by the way, the Consumer Prices Index. Us, we just have a single price in our Consumer Prices Index. Amir Bhavali, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. Look, it struck me. That's all I'm telling you. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.